There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5. Glad to have you here on this Wednesday edition of the show. A couple hours of live local talk in front of you. I do want to just for a second touch on the weather. You heard Dr. Bill's forecast there. But currently, if you're in Mobile, Baldwin counties, if you're listening to us back in southeast Mississippi, northwest Florida, pretty much all of us under this rain right now, and it's going to stick with us for a while. I just wish we'd get a little something here to knock the dust down, right? I guess it's been like drier than normal winter, and then, as we always joke, it'll make itself get itself back to average, and it's doing it right now. Pretty significant rainfall in our area. We'll talk more about that and get an update from Dr. Bill coming up at around 12:35. All right, in hour number two of the show, I want you to make sure you put that stick around for hour number two, because State Senator Chris Elliott's going to join us. He was on this show a couple times and on Jeff Poore's show, and it said he was a no vote, and he then was a no vote on the gambling bills as they were presented in the past in the Senate. Now he is a yes vote as of last night. We'll talk to him about that. And we'll also get a discussion from my buddy Cameron Smith, AL.com, the Triptych Foundation. Let's start off with gambling and talk about what is, I don't know, mama's home cooking going on. Is that what you're feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complete inability of the legislature to just say, hey, the people of Alabama are okay with a lottery and maybe some casino gambling, but they just want to see like a normal competitive environment. And it's an inability to say, we're not going to rig the game. I mean, that literally is the biggest problem with the thing. I don't really care about the moral arguments right now about gambling and stuff like that. This is a conservative principle argument of, hey, if you're going to allow economic activity to happen, allow it on competitive terms. Allow that. And this bill is better in the sense that it does allow competitive bidding. But here's what they did in this bill is they said, we're going to allow competitive bidding, but it's for a covered location that just happens to be where the existing gambling operators are in the state. And those operators have the ability to see the bids and place the highest bid at the end of the bidding process. It literally says in the legislation, they have a right to the high bid, that if they want to make the high bid, they can do that. And my point is why do you give that home cooking to these folks rather than saying, hey, you can come bid like everybody else, and here are the locations that we're going to allow this. We may open it up in more locations. But, I mean, there's even provisions in there that the licenses are for 10 years. And if you add another location inside of the 10-year window, then any license fees due are void. And it's that kind of stuff where it's like, who wrote the bill? I mean, was it the gaming folks? I mean, come on.
Yes, it was the gaming folks.
I mean, come on. Somebody's got to read the details. You know, I spent the last hour or two kind of perusing through it and looking, and I'm like, wow, you know, that come on. I mean, that's ridiculous. And they tweaked the sports wagering language to say, well, the commission can approve this, but again, if sports wagering is allowed outside the covered locations, the license fees are void. I mean, so it's this kind of, you know, ticky-tacky stuff that's like, come on. I mean, it's okay to allow the thing. It's okay to allow competition. You can do it. You can be conservative. I know that that's hard, but give it a go.
All right, so much that I want to comment on here. So looking at this and looking at the exactly what you said. First of all, let's address this part about the bid, because you said this is bill's a little bit better. You said it, so did my friend and coworker Dalton. I will argue with both y'all that it's not, because it tries to be. It's representing itself to be something that it still isn't, and that is number one, a opportunity for the state to get the most revenue possible for this this right to run casinos here, and number two, to act like it's truly free. So I put this into Sullivanese earlier and said, okay, you and I are at a charity auction, Cameron, right? We're at whatever thing, and they have a live and silent auction. They got a fish dinner, and you and I are going to bid on whatever it is. It's a trip to Mexico, or it's a new fishing rod package, whatever it is. And so we're all getting to bid in this auction. And then when they go, going once, going twice, and I buy the fishing rod package for, you know, $300, then you get to walk in and say, $301, it's mine. What was the purpose of going through the auction in the first place then?
Yeah, and I mean, I think what's interesting there is if let's say a deep pocket, you know, a big gaming operator like a Vegas-style person said, hey, we want to come in and we think this is an economic opportunity, we're going to bid this up. Sure, it could get more expensive and they could sort of go into a bidding war. But again, this is why the game's rigged, because it's like, it's not for locations where you can get the permitting in Alabama. It's not for six general casino licenses. It's in very specific locations where there are existing operators. And so the idea of, well, I would have to go into that community, go
buy
secure
property,
the casino license.
Yep.
Exactly. And so, I mean, this is so rigged, it's not funny. If it were, hey, wherever you can get local approval to build the facility, we're only going to allow six or nine, whatever the number is, it doesn't matter. And then they said, wherever you can get approval to build it, totally okay. You do your market analysis and go in. Sure, that's one thing. But if I'm, let's just say I'm worth $1 billion and I love gambling and I want to open a casino in Alabama. Well, if I'm limited to, say, I want to do it in Greene County. Well, do you think that the Greene County officials and other folks like that are going to give me a permit to come in there and compete with the home cooking? I mean, come on. Like, that is just the height of ignorance to suggest that this is really competitive because of the structure in place. It is, I will say it is better in the sense that it's at least giving the window dressing, but your point of, well, it's just window dressing is very well taken, because at the end of the day, it's trying to move it towards that, but it just falls flat on its face.
That's why I think it's worse, because it will give people who don't study this, look into it any further, this idea that it is fair or more free market when it isn't. I'd rather it just be obvious when people you know, are calling their members of the legislature about this, that they know the home cooking's in. This is kind of, yeah, and I mean, there's so many things. Like, if I have a facility already and I got a bid for this and you got a bid for this, I have the benefit of not having to build a new facility. You're going to have to acquire land or do that. Or like you said, you're going to get home cooked at a county level. Although I do believe we should do this by counties. Counties, all 67 counties should be able to make their own decision. But that's not happening here. I think it's worse because it's for somebody who doesn't look to the next paragraph. They think, oh, well, they're going to make it. Okay, well, my issue was one of competition, and they solved that problem. They have not solved that problem.
No, they haven't. And I mean that, but I mean, this is what I keep telling folks. If you think this isn't going to be rigged, the legislators pushing this can't. They can't unrig it. And it's a structural problem. And here's the reason why. Because the folks that represent the communities with gambling, in many respects, illegal gambling operations already in existence, are saying, if you don't give me a home-cooked casino deal, I'm not voting for your lottery. And so the folks that want a lottery say, okay, whatever, we don't care. Just get this. I don't want this stuff in my backyard, but we do want the lottery, so here you go. That's the exchange that's taking place here. And so the idea that, oh, we're going to have a lottery and a competitive situation in Alabama when it comes to casino-style gambling is a fiction. And that's why this has, consistently failed, because there's been enough legislators to stand up and be like, look, I'm a conservative. I look at this. Whether I like gambling or not isn't the point. Rigging the game for a few competitors is something I'm not interested in, and they kill it. And right now, that didn't happen in the Senate, and we'll see if it happens in the House.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a second, but just to circle back around, I mean, if they're going to come out and roll out, hey, this is why we should do it, this is why we should have gaming, I say it's a liberty question, but if they say it's because it's this much revenue, look at this, here's how much money it brings into the state of Alabama, then if that is the driving force behind somebody wanting this, then are you telling me that this is the best way to bring the top dollar to the state, or would it be a true open bidding process to get those licenses? I don't think that's a hard one to answer, but it's one that seems to be falling on deaf ears in Montgomery.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is just dumb. I mean, at the end of the day, if I'm an existing operator and I'm saying, okay, no one practically can compete with me, so I'm going to bid for this license, but I am not going to bid a lot. Well, that doesn't help the state.
Right.
And the idea of I don't have to bid a lot. And oh, by the way, if the state did make it more competitive within the 10-year window of that license, well, I don't have to pay the license fee anymore. So, hey, this is a win-win for me. And that is the reality there on the ground. And again, I think the answer here is easy. The House could look at it and say, hey, you know what? We're going to have X number of casino operation licenses. Wherever you can get one approved with the local folks, you can do it. So we're doing open bidding for these licenses. And if you don't have one, you get shut down. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It is not, it does not have to be complicated, but I can tell you what would happen. That bill would go nowhere because the only interest in casino style gambling in Alabama is from the existing operators who just want a rubber stamp of what they've already been doing.
All right, we'll continue this conversation with Cameron Smith from AL.com, the Triptych Foundation, plus Biden's gun control plans in the mix as well. Be right back.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile online, fmtalk1065.com. We got the fantastic Facebook page, just facebook.com/fmtalk1065. The growing everyday Instagram page and the mediocre Twitter feed. Y'all go judge it at FM Talk 106.5 because that's what I'm responsible for. All right, continue our conversation with my buddy Cameron Smith. He's with AL.com and the Triptych Foundation. I do want to continue a little bit more of this gaming talk, and then we'll get into the President Biden's executive action and plans for gun control out there. But on this gaming issue, we're right now going to be once again like forced into it's this or nothing, and I think that tells the voters in Alabama your concerns are not important anymore. They know you'll vote for it, so everybody else is getting to make the decision. So I would encourage you, if you're somebody that you want gaming, I don't care, I'm agnostic about it, but you want gaming here, it may be worth you saying no right now till y'all get this right, not just give me something.
Yeah, that's always the case. And I mean, this is a situation where, I mean, if you don't have competition, that's where you get like the creepy, gross facilities. That's where you get people saying, well, I don't have to invest in any consumer facing upgrades because there's no other game in town.
Yep.
If that's what you want, this is a bill for you. If you want competition, if you want people to be on their toes, insist on a market driven approach to this stuff that, frankly, Republicans should be ashamed of this. At least Democrats are like, we don't mind using government control to skew the market the way we want. But for Republicans to do the same thing, like, don't tell me you're a conservative when you don't believe in competition. And you really don't. You want government control based out of Montgomery for a whole segment of economic activity. I mean, you can have reasonable guardrails and restraints. I'm giving you a path to a conservative plan that allows for gaming. It's just you're going to have to let go of the home cooking. And if that's the case, that you've got representatives that say, either you give me home cooked gambling or
yep,
we have principle. Well, guess what? Maybe you need the better legislators.
Well, and you've said that in the past, too. And I think this is probably a good touch point, right, for people to look at that when they who are they looking to make the decision on whether they'll vote yes or no? I'm going to, you know, I'm going to ask many of them from around here. How what made you make, you know, your yes vote, or what makes you make a no vote? What is your reasoning for it?
Yeah, and I think that you should. And my issue is that I'm not, and you know this, I'm not one of these strident types that says my way or the highway. I understand that legislative accomplishments are usually, it's a sausage-making process. We know that. But you still have to maintain a sense of principle. And when something is in front of you that is cronyism at its worst, then a conservative should look at that and say, hey, I'll help you get to a yes, but you got to help me by allowing a competitive principle to take root. And look, if Alabamians are so concerned that casinos are so bad that the only way you can have them is if the market is so restricted, then maybe you shouldn't do them. I don't think that's the case. I just think that this is home cooking, and it feels a lot like Alabama's ABC system, mm-hmm. where it's, well, we want to maximize revenue, but we want to control consumption. I mean, how dumb is that system? The two things are at odds within the same thing. And, you know, we believe the fiction that it's a big balancing. It's not. It's just government control. And conservatives should be like, this is dumb.
Yeah, okay. How about this? I want to add a line to the bill as it goes into the House here. We're talking about the House part of it, that if this deal is going, if this goes through, this is what gets put up as a CA and is passed, that the gaming will fall under the PSC, because at that point it's a utility. There's not competition, so the Public Service Commission would be able to regulate gaming the way they do power and water and gas.
Yeah, I mean, and you and I have discussed that. I mean, sure, hey, we will make sure you get your 10% return on equity, and then everything else goes to the state. I mean, come on. That's bonkers. And I think that's where people should say, yeah, this is not a good deal. It is so rigged. And again, this is not about the morality of doing it. It's about the principle of, you know, having enabling legislation that does it right. And this doesn't fit that bill.
Yeah, you do have to challenge yourself, y'all, because I look at this, and while I'm fairly agnostic on the gambling side, SB 214, that's another bill associated with this that has the money for high-speed broadband, internet access, rural health care, mental health care, agricultural programs, roads and bridges, and more. That's written for me. Those are things that I like. But still, I like that, and that's great, but it's not great enough to make the wrong decision here.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned, Sean, the Public Service Commission, because, for example, Alabama Power can't donate to political candidates. That language is actually written into the bill, mm-hmm. that these operators can't, you know, influence the legislature, can't, you know, get. Well, what you're acknowledging is that the market is so constrained that having that ability to dictate like that, to engage in the normal political stuff is problematic. And so that's another red flag for me. I mean, if it's just a normal business like other businesses, then you don't need those prohibitions there. But if it's a captured market, then you do. And that clearly tells me that this is not competitive.
Now, let's quickly turn to the House and this idea that I would say that the House seems like it might be a sure thing in the fact that you had Senate votes change. And this idea that if I'm a senator, I don't want to go on the line on this vote, yes or, you know, or be a yes vote here for it to go die in the House. And so for votes to have changed, do you think they're given some assurances that this goes and makes it through the House?
Yeah, the question for me is, does the House make any changes? Because the voting power in the House is different than the Senate. The delegations that represent incumbent operators don't have as much sway. And so it could be the case that this bill goes to committee, is, you know, marked up, and there's other changes made, which would mean it'd have to go back to the Senate. And so I think that's probably the reality, because I think some of the House members are going to say, well, I don't mind voting for it, but I mean, this home cooking, this stuff doesn't square quite right because it's not real. And once they do that, the question will be for those senators, do you want, you know, the incumbent folks to compete like everybody else, or do you want to kill the bill? And I think it'd be a little surprising. It's possible if it just sailed through the House. But I've talked to a number of legislators and other kind of political insiders, and I don't think anybody's expecting this thing to just, you know, be a quick up or down vote in the House.
I want to point this out as we go to the news break, too, that this is dominating the discussion in Montgomery. It's dominated Cameron and I's conversation, and it's about gaming. And that's probably because they've already got everything done on prison funding. That's all finished and put to bed, right?
You know, it's on a number of fronts
here. Just want to
check. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Well, look, come on. I mean, the practical day-to-day stuff and dealing with a bunch of these other issues is there. But, man, I mean, this one's sucking all the air out of the room.
Yeah, but the thing that could be put the state of Alabama into receivership or Department of Corrections, they have, if I'm checking my notes, they haven't solved that problem yet, but we are talking about gaming. All right, coming right back, North Cameron Smith, AL.com, and the Triptych Foundation. Once you check out these latest story over at AL.com, thoughts and prayers as effective as Biden's gun control. That's next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 12:35, FM Talk 106.5, online at fmtalk1065.com. The segment of the show brought to you by 1-800-GOT-JUNK, online at 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com. Your only job, we get two jobs. You have to identify the junk, right? It could be at your home, it could be an office, it could be outside. It'd be the big swing set and trampoline, and your youngest child's in their 30s. I'm not here to judge. I'm just offering ideas and help here. You got junk, you need it gone. You don't know how to get rid of it. That's when you use my buddy Trey from 1-800-GOT-JUNK. And that's your other job here, is just to go online to 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com or pick up the phone and call 1-800-GOT-JUNK and make an appointment. They'll find a day that works for you, a window of time that works for you. They'll set an appointment, actual time, and they show up. They quote your price, you say yes, and get to work and get it done. It's 1-800-GOT-JUNK, online at 1-800-GOT-JUNK. They've been doing it for 13 years in Mobile and Baldwin County, doing fantastic work, and a buddy of mine. So check them out today, 1-800-GOT-JUNK. Continue our conversation with Cameron Smith from AL.com and the Triptych Foundation. And if you'll go check out his Twitter feed, my Twitter feed, or just go to AL.com, you'll see thoughts and prayers as effective as Biden's gun control. So your latest here about, you start off with a quote here from then presidential candidate Kamala Harris, and that was what?
It was that thoughts and prayers aren't enough. We need action. And, you know, that sounds bold, right? Like everybody's pro-action and anti-inaction. But when it came to the Biden administration's bold gun proposals, I looked at it, and this happened, you know, a week or so ago, and I'm like, I don't get it. Because it was, you know, going after pistol stabilizers and ghost guns and like some model legislation. And I'm like, wait a minute, what is going on here? Because this is not the sweeping changes. And so I started to look into it, and I said, well, what's going on? I kind of heard some of the, you know, conversation around, well, mass shootings this and assault rifles that and high capacity magazines. I started looking at the data, and the data is pretty clear that in terms of guns that kill people, it's handguns, and it's not assault rifles, it's not these mass shooting events. It's just, unfortunately, what I would call day-to-day criminals who, you know, folks have made bad decisions and shoot people with a pistol that's, you know, by most standards, going to be found constitutionally protected. And that's the reality. But that's really uncomfortable because, you know, we don't pay a lot of attention to random individual murders and suicides. We pay attention to the mass shooting style events. But when we do that, it draws our focus to stuff that, you know, for example, a pistol stabilizer that isn't going to actually save that many lives. And most gun owners look at it as an incremental attack on the mm-hmm. Second Amendment. And what I mean by that is gun control advocates are in this uncomfortable place because it's either these kind of marginal things that don't really do much, or they're having to go after the handguns, which means they're going after the Second Amendment. This is not sort of, for example, even the most restrictive magazine restrictions are 10 rounds. Well, guess what? I mean, that's pretty common in a pistol. And so the idea of, well, that's where most of the murders happen. That's where most of the, that's what's used in most of the violence. But there's not a great way to go after handguns with the Second Amendment being what it is. That you have two options. You can either go after the ghost guns, which isn't the big driver of the issue, or you can go after the Second Amendment, which is still a political third rail. And so I think that the answer is we've got to focus on, why are so many folks killing other people, and why is it in specific demographics? Why are 70-something percent of the suicides white male? Like, we need to start looking at what's causing this, because I just think the reality for gun control advocates just isn't that good, and I think the Biden plan kind of bears that out, because it's kind of a nothing burger.
That it is a barometer of the lack of votes in the Democrat. I mean, the Democrats have the House, they have the Senate, and they have the White House, but yet they don't go with what they gun control advocates want. You're right. The number one thing, if they could have it, would be repeal of the Second Amendment. But they don't. They still don't have, even within Democrat ranks, when they control it, they don't have the votes. That's what this tells me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's because there's sort of this very progressive narrative that's like, well, you know, you don't need this gun, that gun, this gun, that gun. Well, okay, that you can have that opinion, but America has more guns than people. Yep. And then they'll point out, well, look at Japan and the United Kingdom. They're trading partners and allies, so we're like them, right? And so I looked at the data, and the per capita gun ownership in the United States is 400 times that of Japan. And that's the kind of, you know, situation where it's like, okay, I see you're comparing here, but we have a Second Amendment that protects individual gun ownership, and it's kind of part of our culture. A lot of people own guns, have the liberty to do so, and this notion that, well, we just can't be responsible. Well, I beg to differ, because there are millions and millions of gun owners. We are an outlier in the world. We are the only country in the world with more civilian-owned guns than people. And relatively speaking, the idea that, you know, if you look at gun numbers and say that correlates to gun violence, we should be number one in gun violence, and we're not. And so I think that we've got a lot of responsibility here. We just gloss over when it comes to gun ownership. And we have some bad actors that do some horrific things that we need to acknowledge and address. But the idea that we're going to become like Japan or Great Britain or, frankly, any other nation in the world, we're just not.
You know, here's an idea that gets watered down to like a cliche bumper sticker kind of thing, but it comes from a point of real logic, in my opinion here. And you talk about the number of guns here. If you do something to limit the amount of guns people can have legally, then legal people will not be able to buy them, not go around, or they'll, you know, turn them over. And if people think turn them over is not a thing, look what, you know, you're told to do with bump stocks. Turn them over or you would be in commission, you know, you'd be a felon, or you'd be committing a felony. If they do that, the people that obey the rules will do that, but the guns aren't gone. So the guns will be in the hands of the people that choose not to follow the law. This is, unless you could have this magic wand here and we go to zero guns in the United States of America, and then you're going to build back who can acquire guns. This is a bunch of poppycock. This is a bunch of feel-good stuff going forward. There's that many guns here. You're not going to remove them all. And if you remove them, you're only removing them from the people that obey the stinking law.
Yeah, and that's just the way it is. And I that does not make anybody calloused to death or supporting murder. I get it. It's popular to convey your political opponent as a murderer with blood on their hands. But there are a lot of folks that they look at the same phenomenon. Let's say we take a mass shooting event. There's a huge chunk, we'll call it half the country, that looks at this and says, you know what? The issue is we need more gun control, and that will keep us safe. And then you've got the other half of the country that looks at the same exact event, believes it's horrible, and says, you know what? This is exactly why I don't want them to restrict my gun ownership. because I want to protect myself. And yes, I understand that a lot of people don't do the training. They're not familiar with the firearms, and that is bad. And I will encourage everybody, if you own a firearm, know how to use it, train with it, be comfortable with it. But that's a separate issue. That the idea that this is sort of a political thing that's done and people need to, you know, just get on board with it, that ain't going to happen, because most of the country, even if they say, hey, some gun restrictions are okay, are not going to be okay with mandated confiscation and things like that. And when you have, my guess is we're north of, I mean, I would think by this time, because the latest estimates were like 390 million guns in 2018, and there have been a lot of guns made and purchased since that time, we're probably over 400 million guns. Unless you confiscate them, they're going to be in circulation. They're yep. going to be here.
Yep. And another, you know, you talk about the fact that these kind of window dressing things that they're going after in Biden's executive order are showing that they're not going directly after the Second Amendment because they don't have the votes to do it. So this wall of the Second Amendment, they try to go around it, they try to lob things over it, but they can't break it. The one place that I see the biggest danger here is in what they're pushing, and it's been pushed for decades, but now seems that the president's on board to repeal the PLCAA, and I've talked to the audience a bunch about this, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. To me, that's the scariest thing, that if you then repeal the PLCAA, gun manufacturers could be sued for somebody legally obtaining a firearm and going and committing a crime, right? Killing someone, maiming somebody, robbing a bank, whatever. They would name the firearm manufacturer in that suit and go after them. At that point, if I'm in the gun business, I stop being in the gun business. And that's the one that scares me the most. That's where I think the biggest danger in this lies. As much as I am annoyed by going after pistol braces or bump stocks or flash suppressors or bayonet mounts, I'm most concerned about this push to repeal the PLCAA.
Yeah, and I don't think the votes are there for that either. But, I mean, this is equivalent to repealing Section 230 for the social media folks. Mm-hmm. If Facebook was liable for everything everybody posts on Facebook, then no Facebook, right? Facebook goes away. Same thing with guns. If any time anyone uses a firearm you made in the conduct of a crime, you can be sued. It's just a matter of time. It's not a matter of if. And I think that's that would kill your gun manufacturers. And I mean, the folks that don't like guns, they know that. And so I think, though, that kind of legislation would require such substantial progressive majorities that, I mean, we're talking if we're in the environment where that can take effect, and that can get through the House and the Senate, conservatives are in such a small minority that, I mean, we got bigger problems.
Coming right back, more with Cameron Smith from AL.com and the Triptych Foundation. Bunch of text in here and some questions for Cameron, some questions for me on this, and we'll pose those next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. Our conversation with Cameron Smith, AL.com, and the Triptych Foundation, which I'll talk about in just a second. I do want to talk a little bit more here and get some questions posed that have come in for Cameron and for both of us here. Get a Steve's question first. And I think it's a simple question. I think it probably comes from a heartfelt place. He said, so what's your solution to mass shootings? So Cameron, we're saying this. So what's our solution? What's yours?
Sure. I mean, the issue I have is that focusing on the mass shootings is not the bulk of the issue. I mean, it is like 1% of the deaths that come from firearms. And so as a policy guy, and I know this is not an answer that people like because it is sort of the popular narrative, the answer is, well, okay, so we make these marginal changes to assault weapons. You could confiscate all the AR-style weapons, period, and that's about somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 million firearms. And because of the number of murders that are committed with rifles that include those, I mean, you're talking maybe a couple of hundred deaths, which I know that those each one, it matters and life is precious, but comparatively to the thousands that die from handguns, it's not a great basis for making policy. And so some folks have said, well, we'll do these magazine restrictions and, you know, ban drum magazines or ban quote unquote assault rifles. The problem is the common definition. The problem is, well, is this a normal semi-automatic rifle that people use, you know, every day and, you know, right, hunting and sports shooting, or is this some menacing bad gun? And the problem is it depends on the use, right? If somebody's using it for a crime, it's a bad gun, even if it has a wooden stock. If they're using it for a crime and it's a, or they're using it for hunting and it's an AR style, then okay. I think that's the problem. And so I don't mean to dismiss this, but where I think we have to focus, particularly in the mass shooting, is early intervention. And while I don't necessarily support all red flag laws, I think Texas's system, where there's due process and there's ability to say, man, there's a problem here. Whoa, let's intervene. Let's temporarily say, hey, maybe you need to not have firearms. But, oh, by the way, there's due process to make sure that when that condition clears, you get them back. And that the state isn't just confiscating stuff willy-nilly. I think there is a way to do that. And I think that's a great way to engage on the mass shooting front, because the truth is somebody can have a bunch of pistols or be really good at reloading 10-round clips. And, you know, they're going to do a lot of damage. And so we need to stop those people from the damage. It's not, you know, playing semantics with marginal gun modifications.
Yes, and I would also add into this that we, okay, it's saying you took on, let's say you took all the semi-automatic or modern sporting rifles off out of the mix. That you're saying it'd be reducing, because what Cameron's talking about is the number of homicide deaths in the United States that are attributed to these rifles. You're assuming that they wouldn't go find another gun to use. That's foolish. That somebody has the motivation. The only way they go do this thing is if they have a semi-automatic rifle. If they have to choose semi-automatic pistol or some other weapon, they wouldn't do it. I mean, that's not a fair discussion, because they'd go find something else.
Yeah, and that's pretty much borne out by what we see with mass shootings. Is rarely are they restricted to one type of firearm. Usually they have several. Mm-hmm. They don't have to bother to reload because they just drop it. They shoot a bunch of people, then use another weapon, then use another weapon. And, you know, I have a H&K VP9, 9mm. Love it. It is a great handgun.
It's a beautiful gun.
And it's got a 15-round clip, I believe, and I have extra clips with me, extra magazines, that I can drop the one that's in there and put a new one in there real fast. And so it's not a difficult issue for somebody to have a belt of magazines. Even if I were in California and I could only have 10 rounds, I could still have 10 magazines around my waist and just flip them out real fast. And that's just the truth.
I want to address this text too. Unnamed texter was, because I guess I said poppycock. He said, poppycock, why was Australia so successful at reducing gun violence?
Well, I think one of the issues was gun buyback. And I think that is one way that's probably constitutional if it's not mandatory. Because I know that people like money. I have seen that with all this COVID money where we're just blanketing it around. And if the government said, hey, if you turn in a gun, we'll give you a check for $1,000. Man, I probably have a couple old pistols that I'd like to get rid of. And so things like that can reduce the number, but at what cost? If we say we have 400 million guns in the United States and we have a lucrative enough gun buyback program to, you know, maybe drop that number to, let's just call it 300 million. Well, that is 100 million times whatever you're paying. And that's extremely expensive. And again, does it have the net effect? Because the folks that are going to utilize that program are usually folks like me that say, this old pistol isn't that great. And if the government's going to pay me more than I could sell it to somebody else for, let's do it. And you know, but yes, those programs can reduce the number of guns, particularly in, you know, area, higher crime areas where there are guns that folks have and they would want to get rid of because a little cash means more than having a gun. Well, you know, that may work. And I do think that's constitutional and probably okay. I don't think that a mandatory gun buyback would survive in the United States.
Right. Remind folks, of course, they can read your work at AL.com. But if they want to find you online, where do they go?
At D. Cameron Smith on Twitter, at Facebook. I'm Cameron Smith. We can be friends, and I'm the good-looking one. And at AL.com/opinion, come join the conversation.
And tell folks, you got about 30 seconds here, they want to go to the Triptych Foundation, what y'all are about, what will they'll find on the website.
Come to TriptychFoundation.org and check out what we've got out there. I mean, basically, it's a theory of how to change culture and go after media, business, and politics. And I'd love input, love fellow travelers who think we need to change the culture, because even on these gun issues, things like that, the real issue is culture. It is not the gun.
There you go. Cameron, as always, I appreciate our conversations. We'll talk next week.
Thanks, Sean.
There he is, Cameron Smith, joining us. And we're coming back, hour number two of Midday Mobile. So we began the hour talking about the vote in the Senate on the gaming bill that took place yesterday evening in Montgomery. One of those votes that was a no that then became a yes is State Senator Chris Elliott. He's going to join us here in a few minutes. We'll talk with him about his change vote and more about gaming when we return right here on FM Talk 106.5.